Lecture 6, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persum, September 26, 2006.
All right, let's get started. One announcement, tomorrow there's no class. Also, there's no office hours. Hopefully you all received an email announcing that my office hours would be today at 2 o'clock until 4. So feel free to come by my office. If there's a big turnout, then we'll go up to the teaching lab for office hours. Room 2068, Cook Hall. Last time, where we left off, was looking at the harmonic oscillator. We defined these new operators, which we now call raising and lowering operators. And we found that they implied that the harmonic oscillator had a so-called ladder of states. And I drew this ladder. This ladder is meant to have equally spaced rungs. As we'll find, the space in between the energy levels and the harmonic oscillator are equal. So energy is going up here. So let's say we started with some energy, E, and wave function psi. So assume that is a solution to the Schrodinger equation for the harmonic oscillator potential. We could then employ the raising operator to generate a new stationary state with energy E plus h bar omega. And the new wave function, stationary state wave function, would be the raising operator operating on psi. We could, of course, do this again and get a new energy E plus 2 h bar omega. And, of course, the wave function would be the raising operator applied twice to the original wave function psi. And so we can utilize this raising operator A plus to move up the ladder. And hence, it's called the raising operator. We also showed that A minus times psi would be a solution of the Schrodinger equation with an energy E minus h bar omega to generate the wave function for that state. We just apply the lowering operator to psi. And of course, we could do this again to get a new wave function with stationary state energy E minus 2 h bar omega. So we use the so-called lowering operator to move down the ladder. And in principle, we could keep doing this. Certainly going up, we could do this indefinitely. Going down, we could do this until we reach the ground state energy, which will have a value E naught and a wave function psi naught. What this tells us is that if we knew the ground state wave function and its respective energy, we could determine all other energies and states from it just by employing the raising operator as many times as we want to determine the nth excited state. And so the problem boils down to, can we determine E naught and psi naught? Because once we have that, we're done. The problem's over. What we'll recognize is that if we were to try to apply the lowering operator to the ground state, we better get nothing, because there are no lower energy states available. And as a result, for the lowest rung on this ladder, that is the ground state, we would expect that the lowering operator operating on psi naught should equal zero. We know what the lowering operator is, so we're going to simply operate it on psi naught, solve for psi naught, then we'll have the ground state wave function. Then we simply plug the ground state wave function into the Schrodinger equation to pull out the ground state energy. So if you recall from last time, the lowering operator is 1 over square root 2 h bar m omega times the quantity h bar d dx plus m omega x times psi naught is equal 0. We can rewrite this equation in the following form. D psi naught dx is equal to negative m omega over h bar times x times psi naught. This differential equation is relatively easy to solve. In particular, if we write it in the following form, d psi naught over psi naught, and we integrate that, the right-hand side of the equation will become minus m omega over h bar, which are all constants out in front of an integral over x dx. The integral on the left-hand side is just a natural log. So this implies that the natural log of psi naught will be equal to the integral of x dx. The integral of x dx is just x squared over 2. So the right-hand side becomes minus m omega over 2 h bar x squared, plus, of course, an integration constant. If we raise both sides of this equation, e to the power, then what we'll get on the left-hand side is just psi naught is equal to the right-hand side. The constant can be pulled out in front of the exponent as some new constant, capital A, e to the minus m omega over 2 h bar x squared. To determine the constant A, we normalize. So, as per usual, the last step is to normalize to determine the final constant, capital A. Normalization means that 1 is equal to the integral of the magnitude squared of psi naught over all space. So we'll pull out the magnitude of A squared in front of the integral, since that's a constant. Integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus m omega over h x squared dx. Right, I've squared this function, so the 2, which is from the square, will cancel with the 1 half term there in the exponent. This is a Gaussian integral. It's a very famous integral in quantum mechanics. I gave you the form of this integral on the homework assignment. And so I'm just going to write down the result. When you perform this integral, you get magnitude A squared times the square root of pi h bar over m omega. If you've never seen how this is actually solved and you want me to show it to you, just come to office hours. I'll show you how to do it. You have to use a trick from multivariable calculus to determine this integral analytically. Or you can just use the result. As I said, this is not a math class. The point is that now we can solve for A, and A is obviously equal to m omega over pi h bar to the 1/4. And as a result, if we put all of this together, we can see that the ground state wave function of the harmonic oscillator is just equal to m omega over pi h bar to the 1/4 times e to the minus m omega over 2 h bar x squared. Okay. Once we have psi naught, we can determine any other excited state just by applying the raising operator. Okay, everybody comfortable with what I've did here? Okay. We determine the ground state energy E naught simply by plugging psi naught into the Schrodinger equation. That's something which is often forgotten, but if you ever know a stationary state wave function, you can find its energy just by plugging it into the Schrodinger equation. So recall that. That's often a trick you have to employ on an exam or something like that. The Schrodinger equation, of course, is just h psi naught is equal to e psi naught. Now h, if you remember last time, we wrote down in terms of the raising and lowering operators. So one way that we can express the Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillators in the following form, h bar omega times the quantity a plus a minus plus 1/2 operating on psi naught. But if you recall, by definition, we said that a minus operating psi naught is 0. And as a result, this first term is 0. We don't actually have to do anything. Just recognize that you can't lower the ground state wave function. And as a result, all that survives is this 1/2. And as I mentioned before, that 1/2 would dictate the ground state energy of the wave function, or of the harmonic oscillator, and we now see that as the case. This is now just equal to 1/2 h bar omega psi naught, which by the Schrodinger equation is just equal to E psi naught, And so obviously, by inspection, we can see that the ground state energy, E naught, is just equal to 1 half h bar omega. In addition, we now know all other energies, because the raising operator will just give us another h bar omega. And so the next highest energy would be 3 halves h bar omega, then 5 halves, 7 halves, etc. So we can now see that psi sub n of x, these are now all the stationary state wave functions of the harmonic oscillator, will be equal to some normalization constant for that particular state, capital A sub n. The raising operator employed n times 2 psi naught. Recall, psi naught, we just derived, has the form m omega over pi h bar to the 1 quarter e to the minus m omega over 2 h bar x squared. Furthermore, we know that the stationary state energies are going to be equal to n plus 1 half times h bar omega, where n is now 0, 1, 2, etc. So we have an expression which allows us to derive all stationary state wave functions and stationary state energies of the harmonic oscillator. The only thing we don't know is capital A sub n. Of course, you determine this via normalization. It's actually about 2 or 3 pages of math to get to the answer. So we're not going to do it in class. If you care to read about it, it's in Griffiths explicitly. Just leave it to say that with additional algebra, and there's nothing mysterious here, it's just math, it can be shown that the normalization constant capital A sub n is equal to 1 over square root n factorial. Okay. And so the problem is complete. Let's take a look at what these wave functions look like. Okay. So the top figure is showing us psi for n equals 0, 1, 2, and 3. And the right plot is showing magnitude squared of psi. So what we can see is that, as expected, the ground state looks a lot like a Gaussian. As we go to the first excited state, we introduce one node into the wave function, just like we saw for the infinite potential well. And it now looks like a pair of Gaussians for the magnitude squared of psi. For the second excited state, n equals 2, there are 2 nodes. We see that now there appears to be 3 wiggles in the wave function within the harmonic oscillator potential. For n equals 3, there are now 4 of these Gaussians, etc. Part B of this figure, the lower figure, is the case of n equal to 100 for the harmonic oscillator. So you have to apply the raising operator 100 times to get this function. Of course, in a computer, this is trivial to do. And what you see is there's 100 wiggles now in the wave function. This should make sense to us. When we see more oscillations or more wiggles or more concavity in any wave function, we expect the energy to be higher, and that is in fact the case. So just by inspection, we know that the lower wave function must be a very high energy state, and in fact it is. Another thing which is interesting to note is that the wave function has a tail which extends outside of the potential. So there's a finite probability of locating the particle outside of the well. And that's something which is very unusual in classical physics. It doesn't exist in classical physics, but is a common feature of quantum mechanics. And we could think of this wave function as tunneling, if you will, out of the potential. We're going to talk more about tunneling over the next couple days. Are there any questions on the qualitative features of the harmonic oscillator? Okay. One of the things which is perhaps most unusual about the harmonic oscillator is that the spacing of the energy levels is identical. And so that value h bar omega is obviously very important. You're going to see h bar omega showing up for any oscillatory motion. When we talk later about phonons, which are lattice vibrations. H bar omega will show up. Hopefully now we see why it's such an important term in physics. Question?
Can you tell us like an example of when we would have a case of a particle in a harmonic oscillating potential?
Yeah. So we'll see that basically any solid near a band edge, so if you're in a semiconductor with a conduction band edge or the valence band edge, the EK relationship will be something which goes quadratic in K, and that will follow the free particle model, which we did before. Now, a case where you're going to see harmonic oscillator type behavior is in a bonding energy. So if we think about any bond, so if we were to plot energy as a function of interatomic spacing for any bond, hopefully this plot looks familiar to you. And so at the bottom of this well, you have something which looks a lot like a harmonic oscillator. And as a result, you often think of vibrational states within any bond as having spacings equal to H bar omega, because it's following the harmonic oscillator potential. So basically, any vibrational motion between two atoms that are bonded together will follow harmonic oscillator potential. Okay. So you'll probably see pictures like this in chemistry classes. This is where it comes from. Any other questions? So what I was trying to distinguish between is there's two cases where we see quadratic behavior. One is in space, and that's a harmonic oscillator like a bond vibrating. The other case is where we see quadratic behavior in K space or momentum space, and that's where we see free particle-like behavior. That we'll find in solids as the electrons traverse through them, but the bonding that occurs between the atoms will be more like a harmonic oscillator. Okay. Any final questions on harmonic oscillator before we move on? Okay. If not, then what I'd like to do is go back to the board or the overhead and talk more generally about the classes of potentials that we've looked at thus far. Okay. So we've really looked at two classes. The first class that we looked at was the free particle, and I call this a scattering potential. Now, a free particle is one where the wave function is not normalizable. It was indexed with a continuous variable, k. We could have a wide variety of energies possible. And you can imagine in general that any potential which goes to zero at plus or minus infinity, where the energy is greater than zero, would behave like the free particle. The only question is if there are some bumps or wiggles in the potential between plus or minus infinity, that free particle would be scattered off of that potential. That would be case B here, where the energy of the particle you see is greater than the potential at either or both plus or minus infinity. And these are considered scattering potentials. In classical physics, these would also be considered scattering potentials. Potential A is a case of a bound state potential, and we've looked at both the harmonic oscillator and the infinite square well as examples of that. For the bound state, the particle is clearly confined in space, and we found for those classes of solutions that the wave function was normalizable, and there were discrete energy levels which were labeled by a discrete index n. Case C is an interesting case because in classical physics, you would consider this to be a bound state. In this case, the particle, which is being depicted as a wagon, is confined to a local minimum in the potential. The energy of that particle is not great enough to overcome the local maximum to the left, and as a result, the particle is bound. Quantum mechanically, however, this final state C would be considered a scattering state, and the reason is that the particle can tunnel through this local barrier to the left, and as a result, if the electron were to impinge on this potential, it would tunnel through that barrier, then scatter off and reflect back off of the large potential on the right, back through and out via tunneling. The point is that in quantum mechanics, there's only two possibilities, bound states and scattering states, and they're dictated by the value of the potential at plus or minus infinity with respect to the energy of the particle. If the energy of the particle exceeds the potential at either plus or minus infinity, scattering state. On the other hand, if the energy is less than the potential at plus or minus infinity, it would be a bound state. And you can imagine that for some potentials in quantum mechanics, you could have both bound states and scattering states supported as a function of the energy of the particle. And so that's what we're going to consider today and on Thursday, are the cases where you have potentials that can support both bound states and scattering states. Is everybody comfortable with these definitions of bound states and scattering states? And there's this important distinction between classical physics and quantum mechanics, which is depicted by this special case of C. Okay. So what we're going to do today is consider a potential which supports both a bound state and scattering states. This will be the so-called delta function potential. A delta function is a function which is infinitesimally narrow and infinitely tall. It's basically a spike such that the area under the curve is equal to 1. This is known as the Dirac delta function. What we're going to consider is the Dirac delta function as a well and also as a barrier. And what's going to be very unusual is that if this is a well or a barrier, it's not going to influence the scattering. So that's the result we're going to ultimately show today. It'll be a dramatic manifestation of quantum mechanics. Classically, if you had a barrier which was infinitely tall, no particle could get through it. We'll find in quantum mechanics that particles will get through it just as easily as if it was a well that was infinitely deep. So just to mathematically state what I just showed on the board about bound states and scattering states, we can summarize that discussion simply as when the energy of the particle is less than the potential energy at minus infinity and the potential energy at plus infinity, we're going to have bound states. In the opposite case, obviously, where the energy is greater than V at minus infinity, or V at plus infinity, this will be a scattering state. And as I suggested, both are going to be possible for some potentials. In particular, the potential we'll consider today is the Dirac delta function potential. So let me first introduce the Dirac delta function. Dirac delta function has the following form. It's, of course, delta, the Greek symbol delta. It's a function of x. It's equal to 0 if x is not 0, and infinity if x is 0. So it's just a spike at x equals 0, which is infinitely tall, such that the integral from minus infinity to infinity over the Dirac delta function, that is the area under the curve, is equal to 1. The Dirac delta function is a good example of a very strong potential which is very localized in space. It's also going to be a model which we're going to utilize for a lattice, the so-called Kronig-Penny model. So it's a very famous way of modeling band structure in solids. So we introduce it here. We're later going to generalize the Dirac delta function potential to an infinitely periodic set of Dirac delta functions, and that will represent a solid. We'll see that that solution to the Schrodinger equation implies the formation of energy bands, which is the foundation of the quantum theory of solids. So this is quite important. We'll come back to it later. One thing I want to point out or note about this function is that if we were to multiply the Dirac delta function by some other function f, and in this case I'm going to displace the Dirac delta function away from the origin, so now the spike will be at a value x equals a. Obviously, this function is 0 everywhere except at x equals a, and so this is going to be equal to the function evaluated at a times the delta function. because the delta function only has a value at x equals a, so all other values of f of x are irrelevant. What this implies is that if we have an integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x times delta x minus a dx, we can see from this equation here that this is equivalent to f of a times delta x minus a. F of a is just a constant, so we can pull it out in front of the integral. This would be f of a integrated from minus infinity to infinity of delta x minus a dx. But this integral, by definition, is just 1. And as a result, we see this integral of f of x times the delta function just samples the function at a. And so many people will consider the delta function to be a sampling function. And as a result, you'll see it also in electrical engineering, you're talking about digital sampling. Okay, so it's very possible that many of you have not seen the delta function before. Is everybody comfortable with it? Okay. What we're going to consider today is the following potential, which I'm going to call the delta function well. By that I mean that the delta function is going to go down as opposed to up. So V, the potential, will be negative alpha times delta, where alpha is greater than 0. So negative alpha is negative, and so we flipped the delta function over. Okay, what we now want to see is what are the bound states, what are the scattering states for this particular potential. If we want to talk about the delta function barrier, all we have to do is make alpha less than 0, and that will flip it back over. And that's what we'll do at the end of the analysis. The analysis is perfectly general. So when we solve the delta function well, we can very easily deduce what the behavior is for the barrier. Okay. So of course, once we have the potential, the first thing we do is we plug it into the Schrodinger equation, which will be the kinetic energy minus h bar squared over 2m, second derivative of psi with respect to x, plus the potential energy, which is minus alpha times delta times psi, is equal to e psi. And as I suggested, this potential can support both bound states and scattering states. So let's try and first consider the bound states. Now recall from this statement here, the bound states are just determined by the value of the potential at plus or minus infinity. So for the delta function potential, the potential is 0 at plus or minus infinity. And as a result, the bound states will be energy less than. Okay. So bound states is code for energy less than 0. So let's now solve this differential equation for this particular case. What we'll first do is solve this in the region of x less than 0. And obviously, the delta function for x less than 0 is just 0. So v is equal to 0. That implies we can write the Schrodinger equation in the following form. Second derivative of psi with respect to x will be equal to negative 2me over h bar squared times psi. This looks very familiar and similar to the free particle, except the sign is the opposite. And as a result, instead of calling this k squared, I'm going to call it kappa squared. I'm not a big fan of this notation because the way I write kappa and write k are very similar. So, you know, look carefully at the notes, but this is the convention Griffiths use. I'm going to call this kappa squared times psi, where kappa is equal to the square root negative 2me over h bar. But kappa is real and positive because we know the energy is less than 0, and therefore negative energy is positive under the square root. Okay. This differential equation is very similar to the free particle, except now kappa has the opposite sign. And as a result, this implies that psi will be equal to A E to the minus kappa x plus B E to the kappa x. Because now this is kappa squared as opposed to negative k squared. That negative 1, of course, it manifests itself before in the solution as I, because I squared is negative 1. Because it's now positive 1, the square root of positive 1 is just 1, and as a result, we don't have the I's and the exponents. So these solutions are exponentially decaying and exponentially growing functions, as opposed to oscillatory functions, which e to the ikx and e to the minus ikx were. We're going to find this whenever the energy is less than the potential, you're going to get these decaying exponentials. That's what we saw, or it looked similar to that at least, in the case of the harmonic oscillator outside of the well. It looked like the solution was exponentially decaying, and in fact it was. Okay. So this is the general solution. Of course, now we have to utilize physics to determine what the constants A and B are. And one thing we know has to be true is that the wave function has to go to 0 plus or minus infinity. In this case, we're considering x less than 0, so we have to consider the behavior of the wave function as it goes to minus infinity. And if we look at this wave function, we can see that the first term, as x goes to minus infinity, will blow up. It's exponentially growing. And as a result, that implies that that constant capital A must be 0 in order for this wave function to be normalizable. So, however, the first term blows up as x goes to minus infinity. And as a result, we know that capital A must be 0 in order for the wave function to be normalizable. And as a result, we see that the form of the wave function for x less than 0 is just b e to the kappa x for x less than 0. You can imagine that we could do the same solution for x greater than 0. The Schrodinger equation is identical because the potential is 0 for x greater than 0, so we get the same form of the solution. And now, since we're worried about the positive values of x, the second term would blow up, and so only the solutions of the form of the first term will survive. Of course, that's in a different region in space, and so the constants out in front will be different. And as a result, we can conclude for x greater than 0, just by inspection, that psi will be equal to some new constant, which I'm calling capital F, e to the minus kappa x. So that was pretty quick. Is everybody okay with that positive solution? Okay. Now what we have to do is stitch these two solutions together using the boundary condition at x equals 0. Once we've done that, we'll be done. So the first boundary condition is that psi has to be continuous at x equals 0. As I said before, this is always true. The wave function is continuous everywhere. That implies that psi at 0 minus is equal to psi at 0 plus. Psi at 0 minus is just b. Psi at 0 plus is just f. So this implies that b has to equal f. And as a result, the wave function now has the simpler form of b e to the kappa x for x less than or equal to 0, and b e to minus kappa x for x greater than or equal to 0. Okay, so as you go to plus or minus infinity, the wave function is exponentially decaying. We still have to find b, and we still have to find kappa. So we need more boundary conditions. Okay. Since the potential is infinite at x equals 0, the boundary condition for the derivative, spatial derivative of psi, is not obvious. I said last time that where the potential is finite, psi d psi dx must be continuous. Okay, but when it's infinite, it's not clear what this is. So we're going to try to determine this. And we're going to do this by integrating. We're going to try to integrate the Schrodinger equation from minus epsilon to plus epsilon, and then take the limit as epsilon approaches zero. So let's do that. The first term in the Schrodinger equation is, of course, the kinetic energy. Minus h bar squared over 2m is a constant out in front, so we can pull it out of the integral. Integrate from minus epsilon to plus epsilon of the second derivative of psi with respect to x, dx. That's the kinetic energy. The potential energy will similarly integrate from minus epsilon to plus epsilon V times psi. This will be equal to the energy, which we know is constant, so we can pull out in front, minus epsilon to plus epsilon integral of psi dx. Then we want to take the limit as epsilon goes to zero and consider each of these terms. Okay, the term on the right, we know the wave function has to be integrable for it to be normalizable. That tells you that the area under the wave function must be finite. That is, the height of the wave function is finite. When you integrate from minus epsilon to plus epsilon, what you're doing is narrowing the width of that integral. And if that width goes to zero while the height remains finite, the area will go to zero. And so the right-hand side of this equation must be zero. The second term here, and similarly, when V is finite, will have the same behavior. And as a result, you can see that when V is finite, this term will also go to zero, which tells you that the integral of the second derivative must be zero. The integral of the second derivative is just the first derivative evaluated at plus epsilon at minus epsilon. If that difference is equal to zero, as it would be when V is finite, it tells you that d psi dx must be continuous. And that's the point. Normally, when the potential is finite, the derivative of the wave function must be continuous. However, when V is infinite, then this integral actually has to be evaluated. And so that is what we're going to do. So what I'm going to do is write this equation in the following form. Delta d psi dx, which I'm going to call the limit as epsilon goes to zero, as epsilon goes to zero, of d psi dx evaluated at plus epsilon minus d psi dx evaluated at minus epsilon. So all this is a statement of this term here, because the integral of the second derivative is just the first derivative now evaluated at the bounds of the integral. This term here we just argued must be zero. And as a result, this term will go to the right-hand side of the equation, and we can multiply through by minus 2m over h bar squared. And as a result, this equation becomes 2m over h bar squared limit as epsilon approaches 0 of the integral from minus infinity or minus epsilon to plus epsilon of v of x psi of x dx. And as I just stated, when V is finite, this integral in the limit of epsilon going to 0 will be 0. And as a result, you can see that the first derivative must be continuous. But in this case, we know that V is infinite. And as a result, we have to actually evaluate this integral. So that's what we'll do next. The good news is, and you can probably see where this is headed, is that the integral of a delta function times another function just samples the other function at the point where the delta function goes to infinity. So for our particular delta function well, which is centered at x equals 0, what it is going to do on the right-hand side of that equation is sample the wave function at x equals 0. And so what we're going to have now is an equation which tells us exactly what the discontinuity in the derivative will be at x equals 0. And once we have that, then we can just plow through because we have our second boundary condition. So let me write that down. For the case of V equal to negative alpha times delta, we can see that this integral on the right-hand side is just going to turn into psi evaluated at zero. And as a result, the discontinuity in the derivative of the wave function will just be equal to negative 2m over h bar squared times alpha, which is the term out in front of the delta function, times the wave function evaluated at x equals 0. Okay? Is this clear to everybody? This is now the second boundary condition that we'll utilize for the delta function well. So all we have to do now is evaluate d psi dx at each side of 0, take the difference, set it equal to psi at 0, which we already know is equal to b, and that should give us an additional constraint. So let's do that. We're going to evaluate d psi dx. We can see if we take these two derivatives that for x greater than 0, we're going to get negative b kappa e to the minus kappa x, for x greater than 0, and b kappa e to the kappa x for x less than 0. This implies that d psi dx at 0 plus, if we plug in 0 to this equation, is just negative b times kappa. And similarly, d psi dx just to the left of 0 will just be b times kappa. From these two, we can now calculate that delta, capital delta, partial psi with respect to x, is just the difference between these two. So minus b times kappa minus b times kappa is just minus 2b times kappa. Furthermore, we already determined that at x equals 0, psi is just equal b. And as a result, this second boundary condition can be written as minus 2b times kappa on the left-hand side, minus 2b kappa is equal to negative 2m alpha over h bar squared times psi 0, which is just b. And what we find is that the normalization constant b cancels, and what we've now determined is a constraint on kappa. Kappa is just a function of energy, as we defined it before, and so a constraint on kappa is a constraint on energy. So we can see that kappa is equal to m alpha over h bar squared, and as a result, the energy, which is minus h bar squared kappa squared over 2m, is just negative m alpha squared over 2 h bar squared. This is the bound state energy for the delta function well. And you'll note that there's no free index here, n. And so this implies that there's only one bound state for the delta function well. So there's one and only one bound state, which is kind of interesting because the potential goes to infinity, so you may think there's plenty of room there to accommodate many bound states, but quantum mechanically we find that there's only one. The exact position that it exists is only a function of this parameter alpha, which tells you the strength of the delta function. When alpha is greater, the delta function is stronger, and the bound state is deeper. That should make sense qualitatively. The only thing which remains to complete the solution is to find b. Of course, we find that from normalization. So we now normalize psi. We take the integral from minus infinity of the magnitude squared of psi dx, which in this case is going to be 2b squared integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus 2 kappa x dx. You'll notice a couple things here. I plugged in magnitude squared of psi, which is beta or b squared e to the minus 2 kappa x. But I've recognized that this function is even, and as a result, we have an even function. You can integrate just from 0 to infinity and multiply by 2, which makes the math easier. So I've employed that property of the wave function in this case. This integral is, of course, very simple and will imply that the value of the normalization will be b squared over kappa, which must equal 1. And as a result, we see that b is equal to the square root of kappa. Kappa, we already know, we determined it here, so it implies that b is equal to square root m alpha over h bar. And as a result, we see that the ground state or bound state wave function for the delta function well is equal to the square root of m alpha over h bar e to the minus m alpha absolute value of x over h bar squared, where the bound state energy is minus m alpha squared over 2 h bar squared. And as I've already alluded to once, there's only one bound state independent of the strength of the delta function well. As that delta function well becomes stronger via the parameter alpha, the bound state energy goes deeper into the well. I think that makes sense. If we were to plot this wave function, what it looks like is that at x equals 0, we know that it's equal to b, but b is just square root kappa. And then it's going to fall away exponentially in both directions. So that's the bound state of the delta function well. Is everybody okay with that? Okay. What we'll do now in the last few minutes is get started on the scattering states. Remember, all we've done thus far is half the problem, which are the bound states, energy less than zero. There's, of course, also scattering states supported by the delta function well for energy greater than zero. So we'll get started on that, and then when we come back on Thursday, we'll wrap it up. And then we'll consider one more final one-dimensional potential, which is the finite potential well. The finite potential well, like the delta function well, will support both bound states and scattering states. We'll find that in the finite potential well, the number of bound states can be greater than 1 as a function of the depth of that finite potential well. So we'll consider that last time, or next time. But today, let's get started on the scattering states. The scattering states are energy greater than 0. And like before, we're going to look at the Schrödinger equation in two regions of space, x less than 0 and x greater than 0. For x less than 0, we can write the Schrödinger equation in the form second derivative of psi with respect to x is equal to negative 2me over h bar squared times psi, which is negative k. Now it's k because now energy is greater than 0. So we're going to get the propagating wave functions like we had for the free particle solution of the Schrödinger equation, where k, as before, is just square root 2me over h bar. And since energy is greater than 0, this is a positive real number. This solution, of course, we know very well. It's just a e to the I kx plus b e to the minus I kx. Since these are oscillatory solutions, neither of them will blow up as we go to minus infinity, so we must keep both. For x greater than 0, you can imagine the solution will be identical except with new constants. So psi of x will be equal to f e to the I kx plus g e to the minus I kx. So once you've done this a few times, you can just write down the solutions. You're so used to them, and we're finally to that point. So we're just writing down solutions of the Schrödinger equation, which are obvious to us now. The only challenge, then, in these problems is applying the boundary conditions. And, of course, the boundary condition, which is always true, is that psi is continuous. And in particular, here, we care about it x equals 0. And so if we plug 0 into both of these equations, we get for the first equation, A plus B is equal to F plus G. So that's one equation which relates the four unknowns, A, B, F, and G. To determine the boundary condition for d psi dx, we have to utilize this same relationship we used before, because we still have a delta function well present. So we have to determine what d psi dx is at each side and then take the difference. So we first have to take the derivatives. The derivative for x greater than 0 will be ik times f e to the ikx minus g e to the minus ikx. That's for x greater than 0, which of course implies that d psi dx at x or at 0 plus will be equal to ik f minus g. Now we'll do the values less than 0, which will be ika e to the ikx minus b e to the minus ikx. This is true for x less than 0, which of course implies that d psi dx at 0 minus will be equal to ik a minus b. And as a result, we can see that capital delta partial psi with respect to x is the difference of these two, which will be ik times f minus g minus a plus b. Similarly, we know what the wave function is at x equals 0. We just plug it in this equation. We see that it's just capital A plus B. Okay. And as a result, our second boundary condition, which we already determined before, will imply that ik f minus g minus a plus b, that is the delta partial psi with respect to x, will be equal to negative 2m alpha over h bar squared times psi evaluated at 0, which is just a plus b. And of course, you can manipulate this as you want algebraically. What we're going to do is write it in the following form. F minus g is equal to a 1 plus 2i beta minus b 1 minus 2i beta, where beta is a new term I've introduced to simplify the math, equal to m alpha over h bar squared k. And I'll leave you with this to think about for a couple days. What we have here are two equations and four unknowns. Mathematically, you throw your hands up and say, we're done. So when you get to a situation like this, you have no choice but to think more deeply about the physics of the situation to try to simplify what's going on here. That's what we'll do next time. The physics we're going to employ here to approach scattering problems will be general, and we'll employ it again when we look at a finite potential well. For now, you can think about this. Of course, the notes are online. If you want to look ahead, you can do that as well. With that, I conclude. I'll see you either in office hours now at 2 or on Thursday. Thanks.
MSE 405.